If you will look at this syllabus that I've given you, I'm just going to kind of go over it. The two goals there, you will see at the on the first page, and it's just two pages, a front and a back, to read Nehemiah together carefully and perceptively as a source for knowledge about God and His purpose for His covenant people, and then to explore how the meaning of Nehemiah relates to God and His purpose for the Christian church. Because Nehemiah is an Old Testament book, we have to look at it and learn about it through the lens of the New Testament, because it's the Hebrew Bible and we are the Christian church. And so everything that you can say that Nehemiah said or meant to the Hebrew people may not necessarily apply directly to us. And we'll talk about those limitations. And then the secondary text, we don't know what those are yet. The primary text is the Bible. That's going to be our textbook. We have a good source, I think, if you could agree to buy it, and that's something we wanted to talk about. Warren Wiersbe's book, Be Determined, is an excellent book. Anything that Warren Wiersbe writes, in my opinion, is an excellent book. So I don't know if you have any of his B series, but he is an excellent writer, a good preacher, and a very good student, someone to follow. And he has a wonderful book that I think would be beneficial to us as we look at this together. And the sad reality is there aren't any other good options. Outside of that, you have this book, which is from the New American Commentary series, which is Ezra, Nehemiah, and Esther. And this is pretty dense. This wouldn't really be a good textbook. If it's something you want to purchase for your own study, you're certainly free to do so. But as a text for this kind of class, I just think this might be too much. So you're free to do what you want because you're Baptist. But do you have another book that you would like for us to study with Nehemiah? Is there something you've read or something you have? Anybody? Well, can we agree then? We'll try to get the book Be Determined if you want. And of course, now if you don't want to get any book, you don't have to. And I think Ms. Mildred has told me we can work with our local bookstore here if you'd like, or you can go to Amazon.com. The last time I was on Amazon, I think they had two copies there, and I think they were $5.51 a piece. But then they always have more coming in, and then, of course, now at Amazon, you can also order used books as well. And Lee was just telling me of another website, Alvarez. So that might be something for you to think. So if you need us to order a book for you, let me know. And if not, you can get them on your own. And there may be an ample supply at Lifeway. I don't know. I haven't been down there lately to see. The next thing, if you'll look, I just want you to flip to the top of the back page there. Some assignments. This is something that I have discovered is a good way to study, and I just wanted to see if you might be interested in trying it. Give each chapter a title of 4 to 6 specific descriptive words, and then imagine that you are writing a sermon or a Sunday school lesson, or you're going to in some way teach this to somebody, and these would be good titles then for what you're going to present. Also, a second way there be to study your chapter titles then and make an outline of Nehemiah. Now, I'm going to give you an outline. You'll see that, but you may disagree with my outline. We do have more than two Baptists present, which means we have more than three opinions. And that's absolutely proper and right. But you're certainly welcome to do that. Also there, C, describe any unique characteristics of how Nehemiah tells the story of rebuilding the wall and the unique challenges he faced and compare them to the challenges Christians face in accompanying God's will through the church. So those are the kinds of things we're going to do. And then I've given you a class schedule there of what we intend to be doing basically each time we meet. So you have any questions? Does this look like a suitable plan?
He has.
And that's why I was saying earlier, you can now purchase the entire series. I think it's in three volumes, Lee. I'm not certain.
I've got his two new Testament.
Yeah, I have his New Testament. I've never purchased the other, and I think that's what I'm going to do. But it's, I think I looked, it's around $50 to $60 if you got the entire series. And if you buy each of the books, I think their list price was probably $9.95 or something like that. You'd spend much more than that because, you know, that time 66. How many of you already own some of the B books? Have you purchased any of those? So you're familiar with Warren Wiersbe and the, okay. When was the last time any of you studied Nehemiah? Because Miss Mildred gave me a list, and this I think was in 92, I think, if I remember right. Was anyone? Yeah, it's been some time. Well, the book of Nehemiah is divided in our text, but if you were to read the Hebrew Bible, the book of Nehemiah is connected to Ezra. Ezra and Nehemiah are one book in the Hebrew Bible. And Ezra is important because, if you remember, he is who wrote the Chronicles. So he is credited with 1st and 2nd Chronicles, and then Ezra / Nehemiah. And the way in our Bible, what has happened, the section that we believe Nehemiah wrote himself was removed and given its own book. And so that's where we come up with a separate book in the Christian Bible, in our Old Testament, of Nehemiah. So if you will just look here, what we wanted to say. There are three men mentioned in the Old Testament, and I don't know if you can see this, and for notes, you do what you want, but I wanted us to look at this. The name means the Lord comforts. So Nehemiah coming on the scene when he did was to bring comfort to the Lord and to God's people as they come out of the Babylonian captivity. Now, I want to assume that you've read the Bible, but I don't want to assume too much in case there's anyone who hasn't. So, if you already know what I'm fixing to tell you, just, you know, maybe zone out for a little bit and I'll wake you up when I'm getting into something else, perhaps. But as you remember, the first exile was the Assyrians coming in and taking the 10 northern tribes, which were called in Kings Israel. Remember the division? You have David being promised that his is the kingdom of Israel, and there would be an heir on the throne to the end, and through Jesus that is fulfilled. But after Solomon sins, his son Rehoboam is given an opportunity. You remember there in Kings, and he stands with his young friends giving him advice and the old sages of Solomon giving him advice. And the old sages were saying, your father had kept his heel or his thumb on the people through taxation with his great building programs. You should lessen this burden. And Rehoboam goes to his young friends and they discuss it and they decide to come back and say, well, if you thought Solomon was tough, I'm going to be worse. And so when he did that, 10 tribes left. And he was left with the 2 southern tribes of Judah and Benjamin. All the other 10 tribes formed their own government under Jeroboam. And Jeroboam and Israel never served God as they should because Jeroboam created this terrible idol of a golden calf. And you have this golden calf set in 2 places in Israel, one in the south of the kingdom and one up in Dan. And the people of Israel come. Now, we believe that Jeroboam's idea was never to have them worship the golden calf as an idol, but to worship Yahweh who was riding upon the calf. But if that was his intention, it certainly did not last long before people were worshiping the actual idol. And isn't it strange and isn't it just amazing how Satan continues to trip up God's people with the same old sins because it was the golden calf that cost them the first writing of the 10 commandments when Moses came down from Mount Sinai. They were worshiping a calf. So Israel continuously refuses to follow God. And do you understand the word dynasty when we're talking about a kingdom? A dynasty would be a family. Today in England, we have the family, the royal family, the Windsors. So they are the dynasty of the monarchs of England today would be the Windsors. Previously, you had in England, remember old King Henry VIII? His was the Tudor dynasty. So by family name, if you were going to be the king or queen of a kingdom, whatever your last name is, that would be the dynasty. So we can have the Moore dynasty or the Sneed dynasty, okay? So Israel, the northern kingdom, they continuously had dynasty after dynasty after dynasty after dynasty. In the southern kingdom, because of the promise to David, you have one dynasty. The northern kingdom is, it falls first, and it is taken into captivity by the Assyrian kingdom. And the Assyrians were a particularly wicked, violent people. I've had the great pleasure to stand in the London Museum in Great Britain and see some of the actual reliefs from the wall there that they have in the museum from an Assyrian temple. And one of the reliefs shows them beating and conquering other nations. And they were a particularly cruel people because what they would do when they would come into an area, they would take all the men captive and leave all the women. And then they would bring another group of men from some other area they had conquered and bring them in and give them to those women and say, here now are your husbands. And what they would do in so doing that, they took people who had a national identity, an ethnic identity, and they destroyed that. And so having done that with Israel, this is why we talk today about the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Because the Assyrians conquered them, and the Assyrians re-identified them in this way. And this also leaves behind something that's particularly important for us as we study Nehemiah, a group of people left in the land that we identify in Nehemiah as the Samaritans. The Samaritans are upset when Nehemiah and the exiles return because they are left there. They have come in and filled that void. And they have been worshiping Yahweh as though He were a local God. And their worship of Yahweh, which had been informed by those who hadn't been true to Him to begin with, is anathema to the exiles who are returning under the priest Ezra and then Nehemiah. They weren't pure enough in their worship. And that becomes a problem that Nehemiah deals with, and we'll see that as we move into it. But just want to give you a little bit of the context of that background of what Nehemiah is coming into. So the exiles that Nehemiah is a part of, they're not the 10 lost tribes. They're the Judah that fell and was taken into captivity by Babylon. Yeah. We all know about Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians. And this is, so the ancient city of Nineveh in the Old Testament, remember Jonah went to Nineveh? Nineveh was the capital of the Assyrian Empire. And Babylon was the capital of the Babylonian Empire, and it is in what is today modern-day Iraq, and Nineveh would be in what is today modern-day Syria. Okay? So these new people who have been populated into the area, led by Tobias, and we will see more about him as we study Nehemiah, they cause great division. Now, the thing that I want you to see as we do this, this name is Zerubbabel. You see the last B-A-B-E-L? Do you see that? What caused Israel and Judah to fall was worship of Baal. And this idea of Babel, that goes back to that kind of worship. And this is the name of the king. So Babylon falls, and the king, Zerubbabel, falls in 538 B.C. There was a great battle, the Battle of Carthage. Now, the two people in Ezra chapter 2, so if you got your Bible, let's turn back to Ezra and just see this other Nehemiah. This is the verse. Now, these are the people of the province who came up from the captivity of the exiles, whom Nebuchadnezzar... did you notice this D? We added that D to his name a few years ago. Someone retranslated some of the... I learned his name is Nebuchadnezzar, and I'm sure you did too. But his proper name now, there's been a D added to it, is Nebuchadnezzar. So they returned to Babylon and taken captive to Babylon. They returned to Jerusalem and Judah, each one to his own town, in company with Zerubbabel, Jeshua, Nehemiah, Sehariah, Rehaliah, Mordecai, Bilshan, Mishpar, Bigvai, Rehum, and Benah. The list of the men of the people of Israel. So they are returning to Jerusalem and to Judah, each to his own town. So this is one of the Nehemiahs. This is not the Nehemiah of the book of Nehemiah. It's just someone else who has the name. Like in our society, we have a lot of folks who have the name John. Well, Nehemiah is not a very popular name, but it is more popular than just the one man. So the name of the three men mentioned in the Old Testament after the period, the second Nehemiah we find, he was ruler of half the district of Bethsur, who helped rebuild the Jerusalem wall. And this is in chapter 3 of Nehemiah, verse 16. And I think I've got that here if I learn how to do this. Beyond him, Nehemiah, son of Azbuk, ruler of the half district of Bethsur, made repairs to a point outside the tombs of David as far as the artificial pool of the house of the heroes. So what they basically did is they each knew where they were working, and so they give credit. So you can actually read Nehemiah and know who worked on what. And this is a different Nehemiah. Now, the governor of Judah during the restoration, the Nehemiah who also wrote this book, this is the one, he was originally the cupbearer to the Persian king of Artaxerxes. If you don't have a good grasp on the world history of this time, this can get really confusing. The Babylonian Empire falls to the Persian Empire. Now, the Persian Empire is modern day, what? Yeah, but Persia today is what country? If you're a Persian, you come from Iran. So each of these is in our day, all this is coming back. We have spent much American gold and blood in ancient Babylonia, and potentially we're going to in ancient Persia. Iran, originally the cupbearer. Now, you understand that B.C. runs backwards, right? So 464 B.C., that's not a typo. B.C. is going to zero, starting with a large number, going down to zero. And A.D. starts at zero and goes to large numbers. So B.C. before Christ. Something that bothers me with today's scholarship, have you seen this? C.E., common era, instead of A.D., after the death of Christ? If you read something that has been written lately, you may come across a C.E., and that's what it stands for. They're taking Christ out of the calendar. And it means common era. C.E. And then B. E before BC. They leave it BC, but it's before the common era. Sometimes it's BCE. So. But he was the cupbearer, the Nehemiah. He was appointed governor of Judah for 12 years. He served two terms, basically. And after inspecting the walls upon his arrival, he realized that repair was to be his prime task, and this repair would guarantee the security of the city. So what we've got are two different people. You've got Ezra, who is the high priest, and then you've got Nehemiah, who is an official of the government, who are coming in during this time of the Babylonian exiles returning. Okay? And here's a map of the area. You see the Persian Gulf over on the far right, and the Mediterranean Sea in the left there, in the middle. And this is what we believe to be the actual path that he took. And if you look at this, you can see you've got the Tigris and the Euphrates River, which is today's Iraq. And because he's coming out of Babylon, okay, Artaxerxes, the Persian king, they took over this area. So they have moved from what is Persia, which is over here, into this area as well. Susa is an ancient capital of Persia. And that's where they're leaving from. And all this is before Alexander the Great. Alexander the Great is going to come out of Greece, which is over here, and he's going to come and take over this entire area in the 300s, 333 B.C. So all this is before that. Jerusalem, see where it is? God's people are on the crossroads between the powers of the day. You've got Egypt here. You've got Assyria or Babylon there. And they continuously fight back and forth through this area. And so Israel is at the crossroads. And so that's why they're constantly having these people come through. And because they haven't obeyed God, God does not favor them. So as these people come through, they also conquer them. Nehemiah was able to marshal support for his project to complete this test of his skills as management and an administrator. And so one of the themes that I want us to look at as we go through Nehemiah is some of his leadership principles. There are some things that apply directly to the church that we can learn from Nehemiah. Have you discovered that in a church so often it's not so sometimes what gets done but how it gets done? You can get in more trouble sometimes. There's some things for us to learn there. Also, we need to look at Nehemiah as an individual who has been called of God to do something, and he comes into an area and he has great opposition. And look at his personal faith and his prayers and how he goes through this sense of call. And so there's a lot for us to learn from Nehemiah in that way. He had to overcome hostility and intimidation from powerful neighbors in Samaria. Now, Samaria was the name given to, remember, the kingdom of the north, the northern kingdom's capital. So you had Jerusalem and Samaria. So if you're reading through the Old Testament and you read about Samaria, that's what it's talking about. Sometimes it is replaced. Instead of talking about the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom as Israel and Judah, the prophets will talk about Jerusalem and Samaria. Okay? Were they talking about America at the time, and had we existed, they would have just, instead of saying America, they would have said Washington, referring to our capital. Other neighbors, Ammon and Arabia, are mentioned as well. He also had to seek economic justice, just like in our nation. Some rich guys who were there didn't want anybody upsetting their cash flow. And so Nehemiah has opposition from them, and there were a few rich Jews who were exploiting the food shortage. We have laws against that in our nation, but from time to time, I don't know if it happened this time, but sometimes, you know, remember the Hurricane Katrina? We call it price gouging. There were some people who were charging $5 and $6 a gallon for gas before it had really gone up, before there was really a shortage. So that was happening in the same time. And so economic justice is something that we will see as well. Also included in Nehemiah was his concern for Jerusalem was temple worship. The temple had to be restored. And at this time it has not. So true temple worship and the ability to worship in the temple has to be renegotiated and rediscussed and rediscovered. And Ezra and Nehemiah are kind of like bosom buddies in this regard. Okay, So here's the background. In 597 B.C., Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon took away the first exiles from Jerusalem. Now, do you know what's significant about Nehemiah being taken in that first group? What does that mean about him?
Probably smart, I guess.
Yeah. We call him the cream of the crop. Okay. I don't know if you remember when President Kennedy was president, they talked about the best and the brightest. So that group of the best educated, the most well-to-do, those left first. And Nehemiah, this tells us something about him, this group, he comes out of that group. In 586 B.C., the Babylonians returned and pillaged and burned the city and its temple, and then took an estimated 60 to 80,000 Judeans into exile. So this group would be us, the common folk. And then there was a small group who just didn't get taken. Okay? Those would have been the Smiths of the day. They didn't even want them. We all stay. Okay? Jeremiah was one of those And remember, he flees then into Egypt. Okay. Now, while in Babylon, they had various freedoms. Some really prospered and never came back, so much so that today there is a sizable Jewish population still in Iraq. Think about that. You know how strong a Muslim country that is. But today, in both Persia, Iran, and Iraq, there still are some Jews. That's amazing. But it all goes back to this. They liked it so well, they didn't leave. The elders continued to function. The prophets, like Ezekiel, continued to speak. And there was a resistance to religious apostasy. Really, the Babylonian captivity was like a refining fire for the Jewish people. And those who come back out of it now will never have a problem again with idolatry. They get that sin fixed in the Babylonian captivity. They will die and they will be ridiculed by nations. In its ultimate, the Holocaust, they will not be guilty of idolatry again. They learned their lesson.
You see that in Daniel.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Yes. And there's several books that you read contemporaneously with Nehemiah, and Daniel is a good one, as is Ezekiel, that help you understand some of what happened as they come out of that. And of course, Hosea, because he talks about the rebuilding of the temple. And we'll talk about some of those as well as we get through them. Now, the Persian king Cyrus the Great took control of Babylon. And it's when he comes, Cyrus believed in religious freedom and tolerance. And so his style of managing the large population that he was now over was different than the Assyrian style. Remember, the Assyrian style was basically take no prisoners, make no apologies, brute, ruthless force. But Cyrus the Great, he is a benevolent dictator. And so he is the one who sends Nehemiah back. He is the one who says, y'all go back and restore proper worship in Jerusalem. Okay? Now, I need help. What time is it? Okay. I was told that if you need a bathroom break, there are two bathrooms back there. And we're having fried chicken at the break, right?
That's what I come for.
What? Thought this was a Baptist meeting. But as we break from Nehemiah and go into Mark, there are some snacks back there. Thanks to you who brought them. So Cyrus was a civilized, enlightened statesman, and this is his way of managing. And you learn something about this in Ezra chapter 1, verse 2. Let me see, I don't know if I... Yeah. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and He has appointed me to build a temple for Him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any one of His people among you, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem. So at this time, we have Ezra going back, and they rebuild the temple. And that's where Hosea comes in and talks about how they're rebuilding it, because obviously they're not rebuilding Solomon's temple. Okay? You talk about going from a Cadillac to a Yugo, okay, in transition here. Solomon's temple was adorned with solid gold, everything. It was just, you know, way up here. And the temple that they build, Ezra's temple, is bare bones. Okay? And then Nehemiah is coming to rebuild the walls around Jerusalem to help protect it.
Nail?
She's coming here? Do we need to help her in? I was told she came last week. Or 2 weeks ago. Yeah, not last week, because I don't think anyone went anywhere last Monday, did we? I hope you didn't. So this is the first part of Ezra. Then Ezra 4, and the people of any place where survivors may now be living are to provide him with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, and with freewill offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. So even though Cyrus is letting them build it, he is not footing the bill. He's letting them take up their own offerings. And then the book of Ezra begins where 2 Chronicles ends. And so King Cyrus, and we've already talked about this, had sent these other exiles. And then Hosea and Haggai and Zechariah talk about the temple being rebuilt. So if you will look here, Ezra led the second of three waves of returning exiles. So by the time the first wave had arrived, when Ezra gets here, they have fallen into sin and they need to be preached to, and you have his preaching of that, of repentance and them coming to that. This Ezra came up from Babylon. He was a teacher, well-versed in the law of Moses, which the Lord, the God of Israel, had given, and the king had granted him everything he asked, for the hand of the Lord his God was on him. And that phrase, for the hand of the Lord of God was on him, occurs several times in Ezra. For the gracious hand of his God was upon him. Now, the reason I'm sharing that with you is I want you to see this. One of the things that we want to notice as we look at Ezra and Nehemiah, and as we talk about Mark, are themes. Okay? And as you're studying the Bible, and this is a big, big word, and you know, you go to the seminary and you learn these big words and you have to use them, or your wives don't think your education was worth the high price they paid for it. I don't know if you got one of those. Pam got a PhD degree, putting hubby through at the seminary when I graduated. But this idea, anytime you see this hermeneutical principle of repetition, when you see a word or phrase repeated over and over and over, particularly in close proximity, then what you have there is a theme. Okay, God the Holy Spirit is trying to tell you something, and it's the equivalent of Him saying to us, listen, listen, listen. I love to hear Charles Stanley preach, but he does that. Listen, listen, listen. And so that's what God the Holy Spirit is doing here. So the thing we need to learn then, the theme is that God's hand, God's gracious hand, is upon Ezra in this return. Again in Ezra 7:28, because the hand of the Lord my God was on me. So we have others saying it about Ezra and Ezra testifying about it to himself. Because in Ezra 8:18, because the gracious hand of our God was on us. And then in 8:22, the gracious hand of our God is on everyone who looks to Him. But His great anger is against all who forsake Him. And so Ezra is already coming in and calling those who had preceded him to task for not allowing God to be with them because they have turned against Him. And again in 8:31, the hand of our God was on us. So you see that in Ezra. Remember, because Ezra and Nehemiah were written as one volume, we need to understand that. It's kind of like, have you studied in the New Testament Luke and Acts? To get a good understanding of Acts, you have to understand that Luke wrote Acts as the second volume of Luke. It's Luke-Acts. And so you get some insight when you put the two together, and hopefully we'll find some there as we do that. So two separate groups of exiles returned to Judah and built a new sanctuary in Jerusalem on the site of Solomon's temple in 516 B.C. And we've already talked about that. But if you want to see, under King Artaxerxes, in 458, Ezra came, and then in 445, Nehemiah comes. So that's what, 13 years difference? 12, 13 years difference? You're still here?
Yeah. I was working on some of David's stuff.
All right. Well, I'm sure he appreciates it. So we have these two groups. Now, I want us to talk about this a minute. Yeah, go out the other one, buddy. The back one there. If you and I were taking a typical course on Nehemiah, or if you were going to teach a course on Nehemiah, a typical study would focus on something like this. This would be the theme. The rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem are considered as a type of the upbuilding of the divine kingdom in the earth. Now, do you understand what I mean when I say a type of something? Right, a symbolic replacement. The Old Testament, because you and I look at the Old Testament in the light of the cross, everything in the Old Testament also has to be viewed by us in several ways. There's you look at it historically. What did this mean to the people of Israel at the time? Then we have to think about what does it mean to us theologically. And that big hermeneutical principle, that big word, this is two big words, sensus plenior, the fuller sense. What does this text mean in its fullest sense? In other words, when God is moving on Ezra or God is moving on Nehemiah by the Holy Spirit to write something, He's causing them to write something that perhaps has a greater meaning, a deeper meaning, a more significant meaning than they themselves know. And so at the time Nehemiah writes it, now 2,000, 2,500 years removed, you and I look at it and we see a fuller meaning because we are viewing that text in light of Calvary's cross, and Nehemiah did not know about that at the time. And so that concept is called sensus plenior. It means fuller sense. And it's a hermeneutical concept. And so you would look at this and say, the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem then are considered as a type of rebuilding or upbuilding the divine kingdom on earth, which is the purpose of the church, right? And so that's what I was talking about. Through the lens of that type, you and I can look at how Nehemiah handles opposition and apply his principle for handling opposition to the opposition that we have to deal with from the world, and also sometimes, unfortunately, opposition we have to deal with that comes from within our own church. Okay? And so we will find some themes that we can see. So that's one of the things that we would do. The walls, a synopsis of Nehemiah, if you look at the first three chapters, the walls are broken down, and so that would typify the defenses of God's kingdom being weakened. Right now at our church, I'm preaching through revival, and I think that right now you and I live in America at a time when our walls of defense are being weakened. The church is weak today. So Nehemiah would have a lot to say for us in that way. The preliminary season of fasting and prayer, when he gets there, typifies the state of mind which would precede all great spiritual enterprises. Before he does anything, he begins to pray and to fast. And so I think that's a lesson that has direct application for us today in the church and as a Christian. Nehemiah's sacrifice of a great position for the good of the cause, to provide a sacrificial service always needed if a great work's to be accomplished. He was the cupbearer to Artaxerxes. I would imagine such a job came with some sizable perks, wouldn't you? And he forsakes that. He foregoes that to go to Jerusalem, which I would imagine compared to Susa of the day, the capital he left, would have not been a great exchange. I'm sure there might not have even been a Motel 6 in Jerusalem at this time. So Nehemiah does that. The night inspection of the city may typify the necessity of facing the facts before beginning constructive work. He goes out at night and checks it out and doesn't tell anybody what he's doing. Have you ever had a midnight cleaning at your church that only a select few were invited to because you had to throw some stuff away? Or if you did, you're not going to admit it, are you? Because the statute of limitation never runs out on such a thing. Yeah. But he does that, okay? The seeking of cooperation in chapter 2 may typify an essential element in all successful work. He really did something. He pulls together so many disparate groups and gets them working toward a common purpose. There's a lot there for us to learn for the church. And then he enlists all classes of people, chapter 3. Okay, so that shows us his organizational ability. He has the highest of the high working next to the lowest of the low. And surely that has a lot to inform how the church should do its work as well. Yes. Yes. And that was the thing, is we were talking about different books we could get. If we wanted to just focus on Nehemiah as a leader, there's actually more written on that than there is if just to study the book of Nehemiah. His leadership principles. My mentor in the ministry is a preacher. He's up at in Tennessee at First Baptist Church of Concord, Tennessee, outside of Knoxville. Doug Sager. And Dr. Doug Sager and I met when he was at Roebuck Park Baptist Church in Birmingham. And Doug, for one of his doctoral degrees, he wrote a book about Nehemiah and his leadership, which I'm kind of prejudiced to Doug's work. I think it's good. But there's a lot there, a lot there. And as we go through this, I hope we will see it, because whether you realize it or not, everyone in this room exercises leadership. Okay? And you have influence. The only difference is not whether or not you have influence or exercise leadership. It's what kind and over how many. You may be leading your home, or you may be leading a Cub Scout troop, or you may be leading a church. It's just everybody has it. And there's positive and negative leadership. Some lead others to join the work, and some lead people not to. And so there are many things we can see there. One example of how we apply this now, this principle. Look, the same methods may be used in overcoming hindrances to spiritual work. The hindrance of ridicule. Anybody ever ridicule anything you do? If not, you've not attempted much. It's overcome by confidence in God. You see that in Nehemiah. The hindrance of wrath and overcome by prayer and hard work. Nehemiah deals with some pretty intense opposition. So much so that they're having to use swords. I mean, they're going to church armed. Okay? The hindrance of conspiracy, which is overcome by watchfulness and prayer. People talking about things planned against. The hindrance of discouragement of friends, overcome by steadfast courage. And probably, I know for me, I can handle the other stuff. Okay, is when your friends or your family start discouraging you, boy, that gets you quick. And then hindrances of selfish greed, which we talked about in chapter 5 already, we mentioned it. Those business interests who were using the food shortages to their own benefit, obviously they were against what Nehemiah was doing. So when hindrances are confronted, the work is completed and enemies are confounded by persistent endeavors. So those are just some examples of some ways and some things that we can study as we go through this. Now, the second part of Nehemiah, and we're going to not go much further on this, in chapter 8, when I teach a preaching class, and I really need your assistance, because this is the first time I've taught a class in this context outside of church. And the folks at Emerson are kind of stuck with me there. So when I teach last time I taught preaching, I taught it shorter for Stan. When Stan passed away, he had a class at shorter scheduled, an expository preaching. And I taught that class for them. And I've taught it at seminary. And when you do that, you start in chapter 8 of Nehemiah. And you see him exposing the law. He basically there begins preaching a sermon. And what I need your help with is, I'm trying to figure out how to put together a course for our purposes here, and hoping that at some point, as I talk to Mr. Hodge, Dodge. Okay. I mislearned his name, and I'm having difficulty doing it correctly. One of the things that we would like to see the potentially happen here in our association is to have some kind of an institute for some of our preachers in the area of whatever denomination to come. And some haven't had the opportunity to go to school of any kind. And so that's one of the things that we would like to see. So I'm trying to figure out how to put things together in such a way. Because when you get that wonderful degree that lets you teach and folks get credit for it, you don't want to misuse it. But this idea here in chapter 8, he begins a sermon. He is exposing this, Ezra is, and then the confession of the priests and Levites that come, the signing of a covenant. A lot of these things have direct impact to how you and I do church today. So the second half of Nehemiah is very critical for how we worship. You will see a call for the people to come and to repent, which we do. The dedication of the walls. We build a building. We dedicate it. I mean, so much of how we actually practice our Christianity is informed by the last half of Nehemiah. Much more than perhaps any other Old Testament text of actual practice of how we do what we do. All right, anybody have any questions? Please shoot, and I reserve the right to say I don't know and have never thought about it. Can you pass this over to the gentleman that came in here and the other lady as well? I think there's another lady over there. The outline that I have here is basically on the back of your page. And I just wanted to show you, I've got some big rubrics there, the rebuilding of the walls, and then I've got more information here. We won't spend as much time on each point. But that's basically the two parts. You've got chapter 1 through 7, the rebuilding of the walls, and then chapter 8 through 13, the reforms of both Ezra and Nehemiah and the way the people would worship. Okay? And what I'd like to do next time is just stay in chapter 1. I see I've got a typo there, Ezra chapter 7. My wonderful secretary proofread this, and I bet you I printed the one she didn't proofread. Not her fault, but mine. So, in chapter 1, this arrival of Nehemiah, that's what I'd like for us to think about and talk about next time. And maybe we'll have those books to you so you can have them if you want to get the B book to be determined, or to, not to be determined, be determined for next time. Ms. Mildred, do you want to get a list of how many folks need that? Or okay. And let me know if you want me to order it or if you want to go through this local gentleman.